pediatrics at Johns Hopkins, who's now the president of a Philadelphia medical school. But Bob Cook showed a film which some of you probably have seen. It's a film depicting the actual life and early death of an infant born at the Johns Hopkins Medical Center, who at birth was noted to have a growth in his intestine and who needed surgery in order to be able to live. The parents were informed about this and refused to authorize the surgery. The hospital, after consultation with its counsel, decided not to pursue the matter in court. And so 14 days later, this child starved to death on one of the maternity floors of the Johns Hopkins Medical Center. And all of this was brought to you in living color, including a post-internment panel discussion made up of the usual rabbi, priest, and psychologist on matters concerning mortal life and the hereafter. So this film was shown. By the way, you may be curious, for those of you who have not seen the film, why the parents elected not to have the surgery and why John Hopkins decided not to challenge the parents. The child was born with Down syndrome, mongolism. And in the view of the hospital staff, from precedents that they had been keenly aware of, no judge would ever force a parent to exert special means to keep this kind of child alive. Okay, that's the second presentation. The third presenter was the director of the Pasteur Institute, Jacques Monod, who had been awarded the Nobel Prize for his seminal work on the structure of the cell. One of the great scientists in the world, who led one of the great research institutions in the world. So, of course, I imagine lots of others too, have prepared themselves to hear a summarization of how the Pasteur Laboratory is reducing retardation or finding cures for X, Y, or Z rare metabolic disorder. After all, if not from Monod, who else? Who else but from this man who once written a book that became extraordinarily popular about a dozen years ago. A book which said that all of life, all of our behavior, all of the events on earth and in the universe are all random, that there's no rhyme, there's no reason to life, that there is no grand design. So a person who would write a book like this, who's in this position as head of a large scientific organization, surprised me very much when he said, I was prepared to talk about something else this morning, but as a result of seeing these slides on these institutions in the United States and this film on this his death. I am convinced that you don't need, you will not profit from the voice of a scientist. It isn't science that's causing your problems. It isn't science that you should be awaiting the solution of these terrible, terrible misdeeds that seem to occur everywhere in your country. You don't need science to inform you about how to deal with another human being. Scientists can better discover what your hearts and your souls are now telling you. Don't search the laboratories. Search your hearts for the answers to the problems you have. So, I'm on my way back from Jakarta. We're now back at the Jakarta airport. I'm entering this plane with another package of good work to keep me alive. Now, somewhere between Jakarta and Syracuse, I figured out the paradox that was embedded in this Ann Sullivan, Helen Keller story. Let me read to you a little bit of that movie script. This is Ann Sullivan speaking to the parents. Mrs. Keller, I don't think Helen's worst handicap is deafness or blindness. I think it's your love and pity. All of you here are so sorry for her, and you've kept her like a pet, or even a dog you housebreak. It's useless for me to try to teach her language or anything else here in this house of yours. So the mother Kate says, Miss Anne, before you came, we spoke of putting her in an asylum. And Anne says, what kind of asylum? Well, the captain, that's Helen's father, Captain Keller, says, an asylum for mental defectives. And Kate said, the mother said, I visited there. I can't tell you what I saw. People like animals with rats in the halls. And what else do we do? If you give up, Miss Anne. And Miss Anne says, me give up? Who's giving up? Okay, so you said it was hopeless. Well, it's hopeless here, in this house. Give up, why? I only today saw what has to be done to begin. I want complete charge of her. And then she said she wanted to take her out of the house into a little house that's located on the grounds of their estate. And later on, Anne describes the asylum she grew up in. Because you know Anne Sullivan was herself legally blind. She, too, was eligible for 94-140. I grew up in such an asylum, the State Almshouse. Rats, why, my brother Jimmy and I used to play with the rats because we didn't have toys. Maybe you'd like to know what Helen will find there when it isn't visiting day. One ward was full of the old women, crippled, blind, most of them dying. But even if what they had was catching, there was nowhere else to move them. That's where they put us. There were younger ones across the hall, prostitutes mostly, with TB and epileptic fits, and a couple of the kind who keep after other girls. Especially the young ones. Some were insane. Some just had the DTs. The youngest were in another ward to have babies they didn't want. They started at 13 and 14. They'd leave afterwards. But the babies stayed, and we played with them too. Though a lot of them had sores all over from diseases you're not supposed to talk about. You know where she goes. Well, you know what happened. You know that Helen Keller grew up to be a great, great woman. But what we tend to forget is that Ann Sullivan didn't truly expect that to happen, that Helen Keller would grow up to be a great woman. And that's the other part of the educability story that I figured out. That was the paradox that had been eluding me all of these years. That before Helen Keller, there had never been a deaf, blind person who graduated from university. And indeed, since Helen Keller, there had only been one, Bob Smith Dass, maybe one or two others. Since 75 years of technology and Office of Education and BEH and 85-926 and 94-142. We still don't have any better teachers than Ann Sullivan. And to this day, nobody could tell any of you that is teaching a deaf-blind person, you will help that person go to the university. Then how did it happen? It happened because Ann Sullivan had made a commitment to another human being, irrespective of how that person was to develop, irrespective of whether that person was going to learn. Not only learn enough to go to university, but learn anything. You see. Had Ann Sullivan expected, demanded, that Helen Sullivan, Helen Keller, would read, would write, would talk, in order for her to continue teaching that child, she never would have begun. She never would have continued. There was too long a period of disappointment, of very little progress. The fact that Helen Keller did so remarkably well was only because she didn't have to do well at all in order to have guaranteed for her the right to an education and the right to the best teaching available. That's the lesson that we all want to remind ourselves about. That there's no further justification needed for a child to be in school than the fact that this is a human being who deserves to go to school. Okay, that's my introduction to my talk. Now, the points I'd like to make this morning, first, people are people. We're all pretty much alike. And while there are minor and essentially unimportant differences among us during this period of our mortality, that will surely end. All too soon. We're all pretty much alike. Now, of course, one likes to believe that he or she is special. And in some sense, of course, each of us is special. But because each of us is special, in that sense, we're all alike. When one hears a lovely introduction, or people say such kind things to you, which is very helpful before you get into before a crowd of this impressiveness and size, you have to invent ways during the course of the years not to let those comments distort what you know is truth about yourself. And one of the ways I've invented to remind me that not only are people, after all, people, but I'm one of those people who are, after all, not very, if at all, different from any of you, and important in the important ways. When I need such reminders, I think of a time when James Joyce gave a reading of his poetry. You know, he had lots and lots of worshippers throughout his life. He didn't have any money, but he had a lot of worshippers. And after one poetry reading, one of the readers came to him and said, "May I kiss the hand that wrote Ulysses?" And Joyce said, "No, you may not. That hand did a lot of other things too." So do you. All do. Now, in a couple of days, we'll be going into these schools and seeing children with the most serious problems. And we'll be seeing their parents with the most serious problems. And the temptation is that not only am I lucky enough to have escaped those problems, if indeed you have, but that this could never happen to me. There's a special category of human being that has a child like that. But that really could never happen to me. Undoubtedly, that mother and that father that you're saying those words to yourself about felt the same way several years before. See? You can't forget it. You can't forget that because you have this degree in teaching or social work or psychology, that you are immune from the problems that you are there to minister to. The big lie is that the therapists are essentially different human beings from those they treat. And the equally big lie, which we, the therapists, perpetuate, is so strong that the parents believe it. That's the other lie. We believe it, that's one lie. The other lie is that the parents believe. They do think you're different. And you don't want to dissuade them from so thinking. It's more comfortable not to. And I'm saying to you that you do not have to, in my view, wear your hair shirt and so empathize that you are so much like the parents that you can't take any distance. On the other hand, it's okay to put yourself in their place. And one way to begin is to every now and then try to remember what each of us always are attempting to forget, our mortality. People are people. The second point I want to make is that we could judge other people generously or judge them meanly. We could look at the child in that classroom and say, "He's never going to change. He's never going to learn." That's a terrible parent. Or how could such a normal child have such stupid parents? Or how could such a stupid kid have such wonderful parents? But you know, in one way or another, we could always find a way to be nasty to other people. That's one way of looking at life. I got two stories to illustrate what I'm getting at here. My very favorite poet, at least this week, but always has been one of them, is Robert Frost. Now, I've always loved him because he's been able to say things that clarify life for me. You know, you open up the books today on group homes and halfway homes of alternate living, and they have these long descriptions of what's a group home or what's a home. And the poem Death of a Hired Hand has a pretty good definition of what's a home. That's a place where no matter what you do, they have to let you in. You're entitled to be there. And that's different than an institution, you see. Institution, they could parole you out. Or if you escape, or elope is what some places call, they can say you can't come back. But if you're home, you're entitled to go back no matter what. It's not their definition. It's poets to create a definition, not scientists. When it comes to definitions, scientists are bozos compared to poets. Well, anyway, although he has been recognized as a great poet, he also has a rap that's been pinned on him, which I must admit is not altogether untrue. He had his very dark nature. And indeed, there was suicide in his family. And possibly he may have had something to do with the suicide. Whenever there's suicide in the family, who in the family doesn't have something to do with the suicide? And indeed, he treated some of his friends without mercy, and his enemies, if you weren't, you were lucky that you were not one of his enemies. He had a very nasty streak. Well, about a year and a half ago, there was the second volume of the Lawrence Thompson biography published by Frost. And being a lover of Frost and his poetry, I made sure I was first online to buy the book. I read it, I loved it, because I loved the first volume. A couple of weeks later, there was, of course, the front page New York Times book review of the book. The reviewer took it upon himself to put in some additional Robert Frost misdeeds with which Thompson had missed, see. And a week or two after that, there were letters to the editor, most of which recounted some nasty thing that Frost had done. Praising Thompson for the book, for this omnibus of cruelty to society, but pointing out that when Frost was at the Red Loaf Conference for Writers in 1937, you should have heard what he did there, such and such. There was one letter to the editor which particularly interested me. It was by somebody who said, "How could this terrible, this mean person, this nasty man, have written such beautiful poetry?" Well, you know, I read that letter, and someday, what else do you have to do but read the Times or watch the Tube? My preference is even to reread the Times. So I mulled about that letter, and then, of course, it hit me. What's wrong? Another thing that's wrong with society. I spend my lifetime figuring out what's wrong with society. I'm feeling compelled to report it to all of my brethren everywhere. And of course, I'm loved for it. So, I figured out what's wrong with the letter. What's wrong with the letter was explained by me telling you what the letter should have said. The letter never should have said that, how could this nasty, terrible man have written such beautiful poetry? We do too much of that. The letter should have said, how could that wonderful poet have done such nasty things? You see, the amazement we have in our work, in our interactions, when we see something should not be when we see something that thrills us and uplifts us and encourages us. That should be what's amazing. What should be amazing are those things that disappoint us. How could so beautiful and complex an organism like a human being who does such marvelous things, who finds ways to go to the moon, who finds ways to write such wonderful poetry, how could such organisms do such rotten or stupid things? That's the kinds of questions we have to ask about people. Because after all, we're all pretty much alike. And we're all wonderful. We're all unique. That's why we're all alike. The third point. And if I haven't already, this is sure to insult some of you. I had a little article in a recent issue of the Journal of Learning Disabilities, which has generated a few letters to me. Not all of them entirely complimentary. The title of the article was, "Bands Also Play at Funerals." And what I was saying was, you gotta be careful about what bandwagon you get on. In our business, it's not just t-shirts we're selling, horticultural therapy. We're huckstering everything. You know, there was a time about 20 years ago when a few people gathered together at a CEC conference in a day where the entire conference could be contained in one hotel. Now that bloody affair can't be contained in a city. And at that particular conference, these few people decided that maybe it's time we put together a new way of thinking about certain disabled people. People who had certain conceptual disorders, perceptual disorders, may have perseverated on certain tasks, trouble seeing figure from ground, had a glalia, this or that. And they talked about brain damage, brain syndrome. And they got the idea learning disabilities would be a swell name to give this group. But you know, today, you pick up the books and the articles in the field of learning disabilities, and we're no longer talking about 1% of the school population. Some books inform us that 40, 50, and more percent of the children in school are learning disabled, which of course breaks rule one of disability, which demands that the disability is rare. I mean, if 50% of the school population have a disability, it seems to me to be a normal variation. They're getting at me. So we're all on this bandwagon, as we were all on the ED wagon of a decade ago, and before that on the MR wagon, you see, or the cultural disadvantage wagon. And when once we felt that the mentally retarded should be in institutions, that was the treatment of choice. That was the bandwagon. Today we feel they must be in the mainstream. But Lord help anyone who asks why. Now, for the few of you here who know that I have spent some time trying to persuade my fellows in this business, that maybe we have separated and segregated and specialized ourselves to excess, you'll possibly be surprised to learn that because I have severe reservations, painful reservations, about institutions and segregated classes, I'm not very much more sanguine about our policies in the other direction. Because I'm not certain that there has been a thoughtfulness behind the decisions we've made. So you got to be careful what bandwagons you get onto. Don't just jump on and say, well, this is the LD bandwagon, or the mainstream, or the group home. Before you know it, they're going to take your ticket.